The Mutual Broadcasting System presents STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. With today's briefing, here is retired Marine Intelligence Officer, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT. Our Strategic Risk Assessment Talk today is going to talk about the strategic implications of really some, I mean, look, to say drone warfare or the use of drones hasn't, you know, been going on for years would be to ignore simple reality. But we have seen some things recently which are dramatic shifts in where this is going. And it's also something that I think we need to be very much aware of as it's changing the very nature of armed conflict and warfare itself. And no doubt this has significant implications in areas like homeland security, public safety, law enforcement, stuff like that here at home. But let me just focus on what's going on overseas, because something just happened, which I just find interesting. It was going to happen at some point. I just find it rather interesting that finally did happen and how it happened. The United States Central Command, which is the big unified command that oversees all the things in the Middle East and big chunks of Central Asia. Anyway, U.S. CENTCOM just sent one-way attack sea drones, unmanned surface vessels, to hit an Iranian naval port facility at Bandar Abbas along the Strait of Hormuz. And what they were hitting was these, part of it at least, was these midget submarine pens, where they have these very, the Revolutionary Guard Corps has these small submarines, which can do a number of things. For example, can go out and set out sea mines. So that was a very logical thing for them to hit. Now, these were the Corsair unmanned surface vessels. It's an autonomous maritime platform designed to operate without a crew, and it can obviously do strike missions like it just did, or it can do surveillance missions like what it's been doing a lot of out there. Pentagon's been increasingly invested in unmanned air, sea, undersea platforms across the spectrum of operations. And this is just part of it. And it's all of it is aimed at reducing the risk to U.S. military personnel, which is what this did. There was footage that was out in the media that shows the attack. It was a airborne drone that was actually showing the seaborne drone going in and hitting the port facility itself. And really spectacular if you get a chance to see it. Had some different angles. And it showed the detonation of the explosive payload. And I should mention Corsair is produced by a company called Sardonic. Sardonic is an American drone manufacturer. They basically specialize in unmanned surface vessels. And the conflict that we see in Iran has garnered significant publicity for this company because it was a Corsair USV, same type of basic platform, that rescued the two Apache helicopter crewmen, which you may recall happened not too long ago. So it has a variety of different uses. My recollection was that particular one was designed for surveillance, maritime surveillance missions. The Corsair can operate out to 1,000 nautical miles and can carry a payload of 1,000 pounds. Which in this case, a lot of that 1,000 pounds was clearly explosive force. There's a social media post from Sardonic basically showing that the firm has produced at least 300 of these Corsair unmanned surface vessels for the Navy as of May of this year. And they got a big contract. I think it was about big contract to produce a lot of these things going forward. I think it was in December that they were issued that contract. Now, I went back, did some reference on this, and these cost about $1 million per. So they're not super cheap, but they're not super expensive. Obviously, a heck of a lot less expensive than building a manned craft of that type, and they can do some things. But they do cost more than the Ukrainian Sea Babies, which often listed for about $300,000 each, but actually, the Ukrainians have brought that down. I think they're producing around $216,000 per vessel. But it depends on what they put on that vessel. I mean, they can put some bells and whistles, and they can put some extra airborne drones that launch from that vessel remotely to do supporting attacks or other things. So it can get up to $300,000 depending on what they put on there. But, I mean, it's definitely a movement in the right direction. All right. Now, let's move to further north. up to Ukraine's Sea of Azov campaign. And you've got a series of Ukrainian strikes, essentially a naval blockade, which is pretty interesting considering they don't actually have a manned navy up there doing it. And it says having a real strategic impact. Anyway, Ukraine, as you may recall, is in the middle of this 40-day drone campaign. Most of the drone campaign has been focused up north where they've been doing these deep strikes all around Russia, going out all the way to Siberia, and these intermediate range strikes where they've cut off supply lines from anywhere from 25 to 200 kilometers in front of the lines, basically leaving those frontline Russian troops without significant logistical chain that supports them in their operations. And this is working very, very well for the Ukrainians. All right. Now, they've launched this big Sea of Azov campaign as part of this, and it's been crippling Russian maritime logistics. It's isolated Crimea, and it has really disrupted Russian oil and gas and grain, I should say, oil and grain exports. The scale of the attacks is probably what's most noteworthy. Between just July 6th and July 13th, Ukraine's unmanned systems struck about 105 Russian vessels in the Sea of Azov. That's right, 105. All right. And around occupied Crimea. And this included 77 tankers. This is that shadow fleet that we always talk about, these poorly maintained tankers with dubious documentation as to their flag country and their ownership and everything else. About 5 cargo ships, 1 ferry, and 2 tugboats. You go, why do I mention 2 tugboats? Well, actually, if you get in any particular port along the Sea of Azov, the loss of 1 or 2 tugboats can have a pretty significant impact on their ability to move ships in and out of that port. So I did find that kind of interesting. Sometimes it's these things, it's kind of like what the Ukrainians discovered earlier in the war. If they took out the gas, the fuel trucks, they were probably having a bigger effect on the Russians' ability to wage warfare than they were if they just focused on, trying to destroy armored vehicles and tanks. And so sometimes these logistics things that you don't think are big deals are kind of big deals. Earlier in the week, Ukrainian forces hit about 10 tankers and 4 ferries in the Sea of Azov, plus they hit the Syrzan oil refinery in Russia's Samara Oblast, and that is a major fuel site in Russia. Now, Ukraine no longer controls territory along the Sea of Azov. So when they send sea drones, for example, up in there, and they have to fly, if they do airborne drones, they have to fly over Russian-controlled territory. If they do sea drones, they have to go up and under the Kerch Bridge, which is a Russian bridge that connects Crimea with mainland Russia. And then they have to go up in the Sea of Azov. And I find that kind of interesting. It says a lot about how well they control that area, that sea lane, that maritime choke point, if you will. And this having a huge impact, about 25%. Some say it's a little bit more than that the Russians were shipping out almost a third of their grain, through the Sea of Azov route. That's all been shut down. Basically, this campaign has shut down commercial shipping through the Sea of Azov for the most part. And so it's very successful on Ukraine's end. And that was a drone campaign. All right. Now, Ukraine's intensifying campaign against Putin's oil industry is having a growing impact. I saw something last week that said gasoline refinery capabilities were reduced a little less than half across Russia. I thought that was pretty impressive. So that was something that's come out of this, but it's had a huge growing impact inside Russia. It's forcing basically a country that was one of the world's largest energy producers. I think it was former Senator McCain, late Senator John McCain had referred to Russia as a big gas station at one time. That's kind of what they rely upon. Anyway, they are now going the other way, and they've had to restrict the use of diesel exports. They have had to pursue fuel imports and confront shortages. Huge, long lines winding through the streets of Moscow with people trying to buy gas. That's what Russia is today. And inside Russia, the consequences are becoming increasingly visible wherever you go. A former Russian opposition politician and commentator, Maxim Katz, said the shortages represent the first direct ways many Russians have experienced the consequences of the war. So this is all kind of new for them. Up to this point, when he talked about that special military action in Ukraine, up until a few months ago, people said, well, yeah, it's just something that happens over there. Every once in a while, maybe a Ukrainian drone gets in and around Russia, but it's not a big deal. That has all changed. The Ukrainian drones are hitting all around Moscow, all around St. Petersburg, all over the rest of Russia, European Russia, all the way out in Siberia. You can't buy gasoline because of Ukrainian drones. So it's really changed the way that things are going, and it could become a rather sensitive issue. And what would normally be a rubber stamp election this September with the state Duma, that may not be a rubber stamp. I'm not saying that Putin won't control that election. I'm not saying that they won't at least, use their covert means to control that election, but it could turn the election into something a lot more than what Putin had bargained for. It's very possible. Moscow has been taking emergency measures. They banned diesel exports through the end of July. Their seaborne exports of diesel and gasoline fell almost 40% in June compared with May, and almost half below what it was the previous year. And it's now reached a milestone this last week when Ukrainian drones actually hit the Omsk refinery, which is Russia's largest, and that is 1,700 miles from Ukraine-held territory. I mean, 1,700 miles. That gives you an idea of how far these drones can reach, but it also gives you an idea of how devastating these drone attacks have been. The facility temporarily halted processing after the attack. Days later, there was another strike that shut Russia's Saratov refinery down for the third time this year. And as a result, between those two units, about 75% of the fuel that they were making is now completely offline. And so that's a huge impact. All right. Then this is primarily due to long-range drones. I mean, some of it's due to some of those Flamingo cruise missiles, but mostly to the long-range drones. And it's bringing the war home to them. And the problem they have, what Putin has, is he can't defend everywhere, particularly with air defense. And there's reports coming out that they're pulling air defense batteries away from strategic naval facilities, naval port facilities and things like that, to bring those air defense batteries in to protect refineries and protect Moscow and St. Petersburg, because they can no longer they can no longer protect these towns against drones, and they're becoming wide open. Now, Kyiv is suffering. They don't have any more Patriot missiles. So whenever Russia fires one of its ballistic missiles, high-arcing ballistic missiles into Kyiv, they don't have those Patriot missiles to intercept them. They have some other missiles, not quite as capable, but they don't have the Patriots. We have depleted our Patriot missile inventory because of the war with Iran. There's just not enough Patriot missiles to go around. It's a very slow production pipeline. Takes a lot of time to get these things up. There's been a thing that's been in place. I think it started in 2024, where Germany will be producing a lower level, not a PAC-3, but a PAC-2, Patriot missiles. And that's going to be done in Germany, on German soil, where, there's no war going on. And they don't expect that's going to start producing missiles until early 2027. And that thing's been going on for 3 years. So even though there was this thing with Ukraine that they agreed with, that there's an agreement with President Trump that they can produce their own version of air defense missiles fired through Patriot systems, it could be a very, very long time. So that's a problem for them. But in the meantime, the way that they try to offset that is they use these long-range drones to cause as much damage and mayhem in Russia as possible, with the hope that maybe Russia decides it's time to stop the war. It's time to stop fighting, who knows, maybe trigger something inside Moscow, inside Russia, which could end that war permanently, all right? Now, I've previously mentioned Russia's enormously effective intermediate range interdiction campaign that has been hitting somewhere between 25 kilometers to 200 kilometers beyond the front lines, and that has been interdicting all kinds of logistics stuff. It's also, there's a land bridge that goes from Russia across Zaporizhzhia Oblast and Kherson Oblast and drops into Crimea. It's one of the early things that Russia did, was establish this land bridge. Well, they can't use the main road along that land bridge because it's become drone alley. All their convoys of logistics keep getting hit. So now they've had to rely more on the Kerch Bridge, which has been seriously damaged, can't sustain the amount of load factor that it had before because of these drone damages. Could end up, there's a lot of talk that they're planning to do a massive drone assault on Kerch Bridge again, which could literally shut it down for a while. And then they also have to try and move stuff through the Sea of Azov. And you've seen what's happened with the Sea of Azov. So essentially, Ukraine is starting to turn Crimea, which was up to this point considered the crown jewel of Russia's Ukrainian ambitions. And now it's become its great Achilles heel. And civilians there are being told they cannot buy gasoline. If they do get gasoline on the black market, it's going for about $25 a gallon. And there's, you know, their tourism industry, which was a big industry there, has basically just disappeared completely. Nobody wants to go there. You can't get supplies. You can't get there. You can't get out of there without any assurance. There's drones hitting all over Crimea. Anything close to Russians seems to get hit with drones out there. And ethnic Russians are starting to flee Crimea and make their way any way they can over to Russia in anticipation of what may be coming. So I think that's the biggest thing. And finally, I'm going to leave you with this. As a Marine, this kind of means a lot to me. We have a history with amphibious warfare. The Ukrainians actually did the first unmanned, if you will, drone, but unmanned amphibious assault that I've ever heard of. And it was in the Kinburn Spit area of Crimea. That's up in that, if you go to that far northwest section of Crimea, there's this little spit of land. That's the Kinburn Spit. And it's been talked about that would be a place where Ukraine might try to put a foothold on Crimea and get in there. But you got to go across the water to get there. A lot of risk in doing that. Well, they sent an unmanned surface vessel, I think like a modified Sea Baby, that went across. And then when it hit the shore, I'm not quite sure how, I'm assuming some sort of ramp dropped, and an unmanned ground vehicle went ashore and according to the reports, was obviously doing surveillance and reconnaissance, but was also armed so it could attack anybody or anything it came across on the shore. I find that to be absolutely fascinating. I find it a really smart way to do that. Obviously, minimizes risk to their personnel, but it also has a huge psychological dimension with the Russians. And we've seen some months back that the Ukrainians were actually using combat unmanned ground vehicles, combat vehicles like that, to take, you know, I think they took the first Russian position. They had Russian soldiers actually surrendering to the robots. So I just found that absolutely fascinating. This is the first unmanned amphibious assault we've seen. And I end with that, as I started with talking about the first unmanned surface vessels being used as one-way attack drones by the U.S. Navy in combat. So a lot of big, big changes in drones starting to dominate warfare and conflict. Thanks for listening to Strat. Please visit stratpodcast.com. You can always go to my YouTube channel at Hal Kempfer TV. You can always go to the website at www.gripsa.com. That's gripsa.com. Also, if you're interested in some longer things that I get involved with, this week on Wednesday, July 15th in the morning, I'm going to be doing what's called a dark skies webinar. We're going to talk about electromagnetic pulses, EMPs, talk about coronal mass ejections, basically these things, space weather that can wipe out our grid system and cause all sorts of havoc with everything electronic on the planet. And then talk about localized attacks that can happen on the grid system, our vulnerabilities, ways to mitigate, prevail, and become more resilient to these types of things happening. Also, the threat of these things happening. And then, of course, if you're interested in all that hybrid warfare and gray zone stuff, that's still available through InfraGuard. And where you sign up for that is through their website at www.InfraGuard Los Angeles. That's InfraGuard, InfraGuardLosAngeles.org. InfraGuardLosAngeles.org. And the second one, the gray sky, the gray zone one, is an encore format, but this one is live this Wednesday morning, and I hope you get a chance to take it. Love to have you sign up for it, and we'll get to spend some quality time together. So thanks again for listening to Strat. I hope to hear you on the next one.